Good evening, everybody. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm from the Independent Institute, as you might guess. I'm the president here. I'm delighted to welcome you all to our Independent Policy Forum program this evening. The Independent Policy Forum is a regular series of lectures and debates and seminars that we hold here at our conference center in Oakland. Our program tonight is entitled Conning Americans: How Politicians Create Dependence on Government. And as you know, our speaker tonight is the economist and historian Charlotte Twight. For those of you who have not seen her book, and many of you have gotten it already, but those of you who have not, this is her new book called Dependent on DC: The Rise of Federal Control Over the Lives of Ordinary Americans. It's from St. Martin's Press, and I hope everyone will get a copy. This is going to be a very important book, and we're the first to hold an event based on it. As many of you know, the Independent Institute regularly holds events like this. The Institute itself is a nonprofit academic public policy research institute. We produce lots of books. We have a quarterly journal called the Independent Review. This is the current issue. I'm very pleased to say that Charlotte has been a contributor to a number of issues. The first one that relates actually to, I guess, the topic of part of what she's talking tonight is was in our fall 1999 issue. It was the cover article called Watching You. And she's had a number of pieces, and our spring issue will have another important article about her on privacy issues and the dependent state. In the aftermath of the horrors of September 11th, I think it's fair to say that virtually everyone has recognized that those specific individuals responsible for those horrific murders must be brought to justice. Yet history teaches us that crisis periods too often produce even greater problems and suffering as a heavy hand of government expands in unprecedented ways. The editor of our journal is an economist and an historian. His name is Robert Higgs. And many of you may know of the book that Bob did about 15 years ago, published by Oxford University Press, called Crisis and Leviathan. And the thesis of that book is very much relevant to what we're seeing today as a national crisis is used, or we see coincident with the crisis, a mad scramble by interest groups seeking corporate welfare, all sorts of pork, trampling of the Bill of Rights, and other measures, all in the name of national security. As a result, dependence on government has been growing. Again, this issue of crisis has gone on for many years, and the growth of government, as a result, has been going on for many years as well. Specifically, I would say, primarily over about a 150-year period in the United States, and especially over the last 70 years. The trend has coincided with the growth of centralized power, which at its own discretion is used to regulate, manipulate, tax, and prohibit. It's driven by bipartisanship, bureaucracies, interest groups, the ambitions of various presidents. The trend has been so profound that few today can really imagine a society without government control. This evening, we're delighted to have one of the leading experts on politics and privacy and economic analysis of what could be called political economy to discuss how special interest politics created subjects and policies such as the income tax, Social Security, Medicare, and many other policies. The question, I think, to ask is, has government really made us wiser, healthier, safer, or has government power been used in other ways? Would we have been wiser, healthy, and safer, and maybe even more wiser, healthier, and safer otherwise? Professor Twight is professor of economics at Boise State University. She's contributing editor to our journal, The Independent Review. She received her JD and PhD degrees from the University of Washington. She's also a member of the Washington State Bar Association. In addition to her current book, she is also the author of an earlier book, which was a favorite of mine going back when I was a student called America's Emerging Fascist Economy. Professor Twight has also been a research fellow here. She's contributed to a number of our books, and I hope everyone here gets those as well. One of them is called American Healthcare. The other one is an earlier book also edited by Robert Hicks called Arms Politics and the Economy, which is a critical analysis, economic analysis, of the defense establishment. Professor Twight has also contributed to many scholarly journals, including Public Choice, the Journal of Economic Behavior, the Journal of Public Policy, and so forth. Her seminar articles on privacy, as I mentioned earlier, have appeared in the Independent Review, and we hope that you take advantage of this work. Another of the many reasons, of course, to subscribe to the Independent Review. By the way, subscription forms are in the registration packets. In any event, I'm delighted to have Professor Twight speaking tonight, and we'll have Q&A afterward. So please, show him.
Thank you very much, David. Good evening. Nowadays, we are told that our government is here to protect us, to look after our needs, to shield us from risk, to nurture our children, to encourage our personal growth, to provide for us in sickness and in health, and to ensure our comfort in our declining years. So let me describe one instance of such government beneficence. I hold before you a sensor pad. It is a breast self-examination device that helps women feel breast lumps and detect breast cancer more easily. It rests on a woman's chest like a cloth during examination. One reporter described the sensor pad as about as simple as a medical device can get. Look at it. Sealed plastic sheets with lubricant in between. Its bottom sheet clings to the skin like a cloth, while the top sheet floats on the lubricant, eliminating friction so that a woman can detect a lump as tiny as a single grain of salt. The sensor pad's life-saving potential is obvious. Yet government bureaucrats kept this product off the market for 10 full years before they would even allow its sale by a doctor's prescription. It was 12 years before they would allow its sale over the counter. Inexplicably, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration put the sensor pad in the riskiest category of medical devices, the same category as invasive devices such as pacemakers. How many women may have died because the U.S. government denied them access to this simple $7 pad? The suppression of this pad is just one small illustration of the enormous growth of the central government's power in the past 70 years. In the span of barely one lifetime, a nation grounded in individual liberty has been transformed into one where federal decisions control even such personal matters as what health care we can buy. Despite the framers' original vision of a government of limited powers, today each of us is heavily dependent on the federal government in most areas of our lives, for our incomes, our retirement security, our education, our health care, the viability of our businesses, and much more. Today, one cannot hire or fire employees, educate one's children, save for retirement, open or close a business, develop one's property, purchase medical care, or market many common products without encountering myriad federal laws and regulations redirecting private choice. Sadly, Americans have traded individual liberty piecemeal for dependence on government, without revolution, without reflection, often without systemic understanding. How could such unchecked federal power develop in a society with values historically rooted in individual liberty? How did it happen, and how is it being sustained today? That is the question Dependent on DC strives to answer. Some say that the nature of political leadership holds the answer. F.G. Bailey saw malefaction as an essential part of it, urging us to examine the dark side to leadership. In his words, leaders are often villains, and it is very difficult to be an effective leader and at the same time a good person. In stark contrast, conventional wisdom often views dependence on government as an inadvertent byproduct of benign legislative intent, ultimately reflecting the will of the people. But I suggest a much more ominous and disturbing process that lies at the heart of the growth of government power. Ominous because it is used universally by both Democratic and Republican officials, and disturbing because it has resulted in the last century in a virtual constitutional counter-revolution. At the core of this process is a simple but universal tactic for increasing federal authority. It entails government officials deliberately increasing citizens' private costs of resisting government expansion. Upon reflection, this concept may seem obvious, but the devil is in the details, and this tactic assumes more forms than most people would ever imagine. In fact, during the 20th century, Supreme Court justices, legislators, and executive branch officials have honed this tactic into what amounts to an art form. By deliberately raising the cost to ordinary people of perceiving and taking action to resist the growth of government power, the central government succeeded in achieving control over many aspects of our lives. That is how key institutions establishing unprecedented federal authority were created in the United States. Once the new powers were established, later generations' lifelong experience of dependence on the federal government then solidified public belief that such dependence is right and good, making the dependence that we witness today largely self-perpetuating. While this universal tactic involves diverse strategies, all of them share one defining characteristic. They increase the cost to us of resisting government expanding measures. What strategies, you may ask? They include federal officials lying about the nature and effect of federal laws and policies, federal officials tying controversial measures to popular ones so that we must take the bad with the good, federal officials' use of incrementalism to achieve government expansion, giving us less incentive to resist each step along the way, legislators putting the same provision in multiple laws so that even if it is overturned in one, we must fight it again and again, federal officials' decisions to concentrate the benefits and disperse the costs of government action so that our individual costs appear lower to us, again dampening our resistance. And finally, U.S. Supreme Court decisions that change the Constitution through the back door of the Supreme Court rather than by the constitutional amendment process, thus entirely avoiding the formal amendment process. One example here is judicial reinterpretation of the Constitution's Interstate Commerce Clause. As you know, that clause gave the federal government power over interstate commerce, commerce between the states, to make sure that individual states did not erect trade barriers against one another. Commerce within the separate states was supposed to be beyond the central government's authority. But in 1942, the U.S. Supreme Court proclaimed that, under the Interstate Commerce Clause, the central government had power to regulate even the wheat that an individual farmer grew on his own land within a single state for his own family's consumption. In a single decision, the Supreme Court thereby unilaterally changed our Constitution without constitutional amendment, and thereby opened a door that would allow the central government to embed itself in virtually any economic activity, no matter how local. Most crucial from my perspective, however, is that this judicial reinterpretation completely shifted the costs of political action, making extra costs fall on people who desired to uphold and defend the Constitution's original meaning. The framers' intention, of course, was to protect the Constitution by imposing extra costs through the formal amendment process on people who desired to change the Constitution. Independent on D.C., I document many more of these strategies. In each case, the government's use of these resistance-manipulating strategies increased the cost to American citizens of perceiving and taking action to resist government power grabs. Using these techniques, the central government systematically orchestrated acquiescence to its increased power. Let us now consider some of the core elements of this government power. Take income tax withholding, for example. Without doubt, income tax withholding increases the cost to us of perceiving and resisting the existing scope of federal authority. Tax collections, after all, are its lifeblood. With withholding, the government simply forces employers to take the money out of our paychecks without our permission before we even receive it. No muss, no fuss. Most important to the government, taxpayers never experience the pain and anger of writing a check for the full amount of their federal tax bill. Psychologically, with withholding, the money remains an abstraction. It was never ours, never tangible. As a result, many Americans today have no idea what their total income tax bill is, and even have come to associate April the 15th with tax refunds rather than tax payments. Back in 1943, when today's income tax withholding system was created, resistance-manipulating techniques were actively used to get it passed. It was sold to the public through outright deception. For example, withholding was said to be for the benefit and convenience of the public, promising lower tax burdens if passed. Yet, in congressional hearings, legislators quietly discussed the tax revenues that they said needed to be, and I quote, fried out of the taxpayers. How they could, quote, get those fellows. This was their actual language. Unbeknownst to the public, they even discussed how the new system would result in more, not less, tax revenue. In short, they lied to the public, and it worked. Just as those legislators anticipated, income tax withholding became an essential underpinning of today's expansive state. Without it, the true cost of the tax would be highly visible, and effective resistance to overtaxation would be feasible. With it, resistance to overtaxation is virtually impossible, and all Americans now turn meekly to D.C. to discover what fraction of their lawfully earned income they will be permitted to keep. What about Social Security, another source of our dependence on government? Even as the program's destructive consequences are now becoming more apparent, government misrepresentation and other deceptive tactics continue to shape Social Security's evolution. For instance, acceptance of Social Security originally hinged, and still rests, on public belief in each person's supposed insurance contract with the federal government. Yet the Supreme Court actually ruled in 1960 that we have no contractual right to benefit payments under Social Security. In short, we who pay 12.4% of our earnings in payroll taxes for a lifetime have no contractual right to anything as a result. Yet even today, federal officials continue to repeat what I call the contract myth. Another myth used from the very beginning is that the Social Security tax burden is split between employers and employees. Although the employer does indeed write a check to the federal government on behalf of the employee, economists and key public officials have understood for decades that employees bear almost the entire burden of the Social Security tax, both halves of it, in the form of reduced wages. After all, to the employer, paying the government $1,000 on behalf of an employee is financially equivalent to paying the employee $1,000 in wages. Nonetheless, the myth of the split of the payroll tax reduces public resistance to Social Security by encouraging employees to believe that they are paying only 6.2% of their wages rather than 12.4%. So government officials cynically continue to employ the deception even today. But were these and related strategies deliberate? Well, consider some federal officials' own statements. At one point in a debate in 1972, a Social Security official admitted to economist Milton Friedman that the employee does in fact bear the so-called employer's half of the Social Security tax. Dr. Friedman responded that he regarded it as an historic moment because, and I quote, "that admission means that many of the statements made by you and by the Social Security Administration about the relation of benefits to amounts paid are, to put it plainly, pure hogwash," unquote. And Wilbur Cohen, who was head of the Social Security Administration at the time, spoke candidly about the government's promotion of Social Security as a so-called floor of protection for retirees. This is what he stated, quote, "Its great attractiveness and usefulness has been that it can mean different things to different people. Its value is in what it conceals rather than what it reveals," unquote. Another Social Security official stated, quote, "continued general support for the Social Security system hinges on continued public ignorance of how the system works. We have nothing to worry about because it is so enormously complex that nobody is going to figure it out," unquote. And the unpleasant truth, seldom mentioned by government officials, is that Social Security prevents poor people from saving and generating bequeathable assets that could extricate them, their children, and the next generation from poverty. Instead, all Americans forfeit what should have been the fruits of a lifetime savings, most of them forced to turn instead to D.C. for sustenance in their old age. An equally shocking truth, known to few Americans, is that the Social Security Administration is now requiring any retiree who has paid payroll taxes all of his life and upon retirement wants to opt out of Medicare to forfeit all Social Security benefits and repay any benefits already received. Think about that. What does that mean and imply for people's ability to resist the government controls contained in Medicare? Medicare itself was passed in 1965 using a bevy of resistance-stifling strategies, incrementalism, tying, and lying among them. For example, Medicare proponents packaged the Medicare measure with the 1965 Social Security amendments, which just happened to contain a 7% increase in cash benefits for retirees. This meant that a legislator would have had to vote against the Social Security benefit increase to vote against Medicare, making such a vote politically impossible. Moreover, government officials falsely promoted Medicare as protecting the elderly against financial ruin from catastrophic illness, even though they knew that the 1965 Medicare proposal provided no such coverage. As Senator Russell Long stated at the time, quote, well, in arguing for your plan, you say, let's not strip poor old grandma of the last dress she has and of her home and what little resources she has. And yet you bring us a plan that does just that unless she gets well in 60 days, unquote. Similar strategies were used again in 1996 to secure passage of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, often known by its acronym of HIPAA, or sometimes it's referred to as the Kennedy-Cassebaum Bill. Federal officials promoted that law as merely a benign measure to increase people's ability to retain their medical insurance when they change jobs. Yet the 1996 Act, in fact, established as statutory law some of the most reviled features of the Clinton administration's previously rejected Health Security Act. These included requirements for unique health identifiers for every American and for privacy-destroying uniform electronic databases of medical information on every American. Unfortunately, the so-called medical privacy regulations that were finally implemented in April of 2001 have perpetrated yet another fraud on the American public, falsely promising privacy when ever broader dissemination of our personal medical information is their actual effect. Everywhere one turns, the story is the same. Public education laws provide another example. Deception absolutely riddled the passage of these laws, beginning with the National Defense Education Act in 1958. Federal officials leveraged that bill into law by means of the Sputnik scare, using false claims of national emergency to build a program that channeled funds to virtually all types of educational programs. Representative Frank Thompson at the time called it a bill with a gimmick in it, namely the tie to national defense. And Senator Strom Thurmond clearly identified the lie. He said, this bill, although it purports to be for the specific purpose of promoting the national defense, is in actuality general federal aid to education. This bill will not appreciably contribute to the national defense. Neither the scholarship program nor the student loan program are limited in any way to persons undertaking a course of study considered to be critical to our national defense. Under either of these programs, a participating student might study social welfare work, automobile driving, or, for that matter, flower arranging, unquote. Such deception has been so recurrent and so blatant that when a legislator repeatedly says that a proposed law will not do something, it's a good idea to surmise that it will. That's certainly how it happened with respect to federal denials of control over education. As the economist Thomas Sowell has described it, they have taken our money, betrayed our trust, failed our children, and then lied about the failures with inflated grades and pretty words. They have used our children as guinea pigs for experiments, targets for propaganda, and warm bodies to be moved here and there. They have proclaimed their dedication to freedom of ideas and the quest for truth, while turning educational institutions into bastions of dogma and the most intolerant institutions in American society, unquote. It happened again in 1994 when the public was encouraged to perceive the Goals 2000 legislation as strengthening the academic rigor of public schools. Yet underneath that veneer of appealing rhetoric, the legislation established federal powers and policies that contravened the wishes of many communities, weakened the academic rigor of public schools, and accorded the federal government increasing influence over the education, ideological orientation, and career paths of American children. The federally promoted slogan of outcome-based education turned out to denote social outcomes desired by federal authorities, not academic outcomes desired by parents. As a result of these and other statutes, Americans increasingly must defer to policymakers in D.C. as architects and overseers of what their children will learn in school and what jobs they will be trained to occupy. Then there is the dependence rooted in recent expansion of government data collection. Social Security numbers have become what Paul Schwartz called a de facto national identification number that now serves as a fulcrum for this vast data quest. Medical databases, accessible to a broad spectrum of governmental agencies, are now under construction. New federal education databases, mandated by recent legislation, compel increasingly detailed national records of each child's educational experiences and even their social and economic status. A federal labor database of all American workers now exists. And federal law for decades, unbeknownst to many Americans, has required banks and other financial institutions to create permanent, readily retrievable records in the form of photocopies or microfilm records of each individual's checks, deposits, and other financial transactions. Linked through our Social Security numbers, these financial, labor, medical, and education databases empower federal officials to obtain an astonishingly detailed portrait of every one of us, the checks we write, the types of causes we support, and now what we say privately to our doctors. 50 years ago, there was little that the central government knew about us. Today, there is very little that they don't know about us. And it's getting worse, as you know, in the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks. By so broadly compelling law-abiding Americans to relinquish their personal privacy, the federal government fosters yet another corrosive dependency. After all, authoritarian governments have known for centuries that information collection is a potent way of raising the cost to individuals of resistance, facilitating such things as political blackmail. A government with access to personal information we give to our doctors, for example, would have little difficulty in influencing many legislators or other people's political activities. Frederick Bastiat surely had it right when he described the law as a potential instrument of plunder. He stated that, quote, "If you make of the law an instrument of plunder for the benefit of particular individuals or classes, first everyone will try to make the law, then everyone will try to make it for his own profit, resulting in the end of all morality," unquote. Bastiat foresaw that, in his words, government will be held responsible for everyone's existence and will bend under the weight of that responsibility. What would have to change to set us on a course toward less government power, more individual liberty? Let me describe just a few of the necessary changes. Judicial reinterpretation of key constitutional provisions, which have served as a foundation for these expanded federal powers, would have to be undone, requiring major reversals in Supreme Court interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause and other constitutional provisions. Federal statutory law, now held in place by those unsound constitutional moorings, would need to be repealed. Direct and indirect federal control over American schools would have to be eliminated. Much existing legislation establishing control over Americans' retirement income, health care, and businesses also would require repeal. Federal government databases on law-abiding Americans would need to be destroyed and forbidden. The practice of using taxpayer funds as a lever to force state action would need to stop. And the massive government control over Americans' incomes, now achieved through federal income and payroll taxes, would need to be severely reduced, facilitated by elimination of income tax withholding and an end to the fiction of the so-called employer's half of the Social Security tax. But even if the U.S. Supreme Court were to restore the plain meanings of constitutional provisions such as the Interstate Commerce Clause, does anyone doubt that political elites and a now dependent citizenry would clamor for constitutional amendments to maintain the status quo? Of course, There are things that each of us can do, things within our own control, that will enhance our personal liberty while contributing to a freer society. We can choose to homeschool our children. We can routinely use encryption to the maximum extent possible under existing law. We can read more widely so as to master the arguments in defense of a free society. We can state our opinions more openly among our colleagues and friends. We can, to a greater degree, use cash for our transactions. We can refuse to supply private information about ourselves that we are not required to give. We can plan to provide for ourselves in our old age and strive to achieve a financial position that allows us to refuse Social Security and Medicare benefits in order to maintain our independence and control over our health care as we age. We can do these things and more. But such actions are costly, so most people will not, and some cannot, undertake them. Accordingly, these kinds of actions are not likely to be enough. If liberty is to flourish again in America, we must, like those who signed the Declaration of Independence, commit our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor to the effort. Clearly, it will be a tremendous struggle, requiring the best in each of us to make it happen. For the sake of our children and future generations, I fervently hope that there is still the time and the will to turn away from our present path and free ourselves from dependence on DC. Thank you.